Hello and welcome to Fraud Talk, the ACFE's monthly podcast. I'm Rihanna Scoggins, the content manager for the ACFE, and today I'm joined by Tony McClements, head of investigations at Martin, Kenny & Co., an investigative litigation practice based in the British Virgin Islands. Today we're going to talk about the UK post office scandal, what happened, and what comes next. Tony, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for inviting me.
So I know that you've been speaking a lot on this scandal, posting articles and things like that. So can you provide a brief overview of what the UK post office scandal is, its implications for the legal and postal service communities in the UK?
Yeah, the scandal itself arose out of the post office implementing a piece of software called Horizon back in 1999. The people who used the software were someone called sub-postmasters. They operate in the community in small post offices, doing day-to-day stuff, sorting out parcels, letters, a little bit of banking and stuff like that. And this new system, they noticed that there were regular discrepancies with the accounting system, which indicated, to the post office at least, that the sub-postmasters themselves were responsible for those discrepancies. And some of the fingers pointed at them in the context of they were defrauding the post office, stealing the money. And in turn, that led to, at the moment, well, at the time speaking, as I understand it, about 900 criminal convictions for things such as fraud and false accounting.
So in recent articles, you've discussed the accountability of various entities involved in this scandal. Who do you believe is most responsible for this miscarriage of justice, as it's been called, and why?
Well, I think because the public inquiry is actually ongoing, it'd be unfair to actually point the finger precisely. But what I would say is that I would suggest that some of the people at the post office, from investigator level through to senior management, are clearly going to be held responsible, I would suggest, for some of the issues that have arisen out of the hearing. I mean, from my perspective as a former fraud squad detective, some of the incompetence is bordering on astounding. I can't believe some of the stuff I'm reading and what I'm hearing in terms of, the mismanagement of the investigations and the case itself. And I think what's coming from the inquiry is that there's also a possibility, and indeed essentially a likelihood, that there's been some deliberate misleading of the sort of postmasters, the lawyers, members of parliament who've interjected and sought to get to the bottom of what's been going on. And all of that combined has led to most of the convictions, as I understand it, being declared unsafe.
So, the root of this problem sort of lies in the Horizon IT system. So how did the failures of the Horizon IT system contribute to these wrongful convictions of hundreds of postmasters? What could have been done to protect from the technology's role in this scandal?
Well, you'll have to forgive me in part because I'm not a software engineer and as I said, I'm not in years, so my ability to understand software and computers is quite limited. But what I would say is that some of the bugs that have been described in simple terms for lay people like myself would suggest that the software is full of bugs, and I'm not sure if that's the correct terminology, which has in turn impacted the ability of the software to keep accurate accounting rules. And the other thing that I would say is that, to me, it looks as though people have been trying to cover that up, potentially because the software system was so expensive to install and use. And rather than admit that the software was a problem, it was much easier and simpler to point the finger at the sub-postmasters. And I think that is where the problem lies. You know, the sub-postmasters, clearly, everything is indicating that it just wasn't them. And the thing about sub-postmasters are, if you wanted to become a sub-postmaster, in which case you become part of a franchise, you're going to be vetted, seriously vetted, because you're going to be handling large amounts of cash. So we can say with a degree of confidence that the individuals who've gone to prison, who've been prosecuted, never had a criminal record or any indication that that anything that they would do would amount to some sort of criminal activity. So I think when you put it all together, you can see where the word scandal is becoming synonymous with the post office.
So, you know, going into these investigations, what were the major legal oversights that occurred during the prosecution of these postmasters? What could have been done differently to prevent these errors?
Well, I'm actually back in my comfort zone now, so I can speak to this probably a little bit better than I could to the computer issue. This is the element that really appalls me the most, and it's the thing that sits really uncomfortably with myself, and I'm sure it does with most of my previous colleagues. In the United Kingdom, we have some strict legislation that governs how we function in criminal prosecutions. One piece of legislation is something called the Criminal Procedures and Investigations Act of 1996, which we all abbreviate to CPIA. And basically all the CPIA says is that as investigators, if you come across evidence that undermines your case, i.e. would indicate that perhaps you've got the wrong person, or that the evidence isn't as strong as perhaps you first believed, or if you come across something that would assist the defence, i.e. to formulate some sort of response for their client, then you have to disclose it to them. And one of the things that's coming out of this inquiry, as I understand it, certainly the way I read it, is that instead of disclosing all the failures of the system, instead of explaining to the defence teams, we've had thousands or certainly hundreds of complaints saying that the system is flawed, that a lot of the defendants have gone to court and stood in the box and said, it wasn't me, it was the system. They've basically failed to disclose all those issues. And what you do then is you basically force the defendants to fight with one arm tied behind his back, because if the court was aware that there'd been all these complaints, all these allegations that the system was flawed, clearly that would have, in all likelihood, that would have generated a different outcome when these people went to court. And I do not understand how that could happen in this day and age. I mean, my policing career goes back many years, back to 1986, and mistakes were made regularly, and police officers sometimes they were accused of withholding evidence that would have prevented people from being convicted, and that's why this piece of legislation came in. It was to ensure that some people were protected from situations where perhaps people were withholding evidence or information, not so much evidence, but withholding information that could have benefited the defence. And it's such a strict piece of legislation, we often refer to it as being a bit draconian. I obviously operate on an international stage now within the British Virgin Islands, and a lot of our cases cross borders. And when we're dealing with lawyers from elsewhere, they do not appreciate the importance of CPIA in private prosecution work in the United Kingdom. They can't get their head around the fact that it does really sort of deliberately tilt the scales, in my opinion, towards the defendants in order to ensure that they get a fair trial. So in this day and age, I just can't understand how investigators weren't aware of those obligations. And to my mind, it would suggest they were aware, and themselves, along with the lawyers, have got it wrong. And, you know, it's not for me to say that there was anything deliberate going on, but what I would say is that all indications are that perhaps that there is a bit of skullduggery afoot.
So, you know, talking about, you know, the importance of CPIA and these, you know, sort of legal oversights, what are some of the ethical dilemmas faced by lawyers and investigators in this scandal? Can you sort of expand on those challenges and how they were mishandled?
Yeah, I think in terms of ethics, I mean, basically, the law says you have to do certain things, and if you don't do them, you're ethically challenged. Yeah, so if it's an oversight, oversights happen. If mistakes are made, mistakes are made. But if you deliberately sit on information that would influence the outcome of the initial interview, would influence whether or not someone needs to be arrested in order to be interviewed, putting aside what happens afterwards when you're in the position where they've been charged and you're not disclosing the information that would assist the defence, all of that is ethically challenged. So, to my mind, I mean, as I said, all the indications are that there's a cover-up, and slowly but surely the public inquiry is teasing apart what some could call a tissue of lies. And as somebody who's, you know, whose career has been involved around criminal investigation, knowing the rules and understanding them, and they're not complicated, they're very straightforward, that would indicate to me that people have deliberately avoided following those rules for their own purposes. And I think that's what smacks of the cover-up.
You know, following the scandal, moving forward past it, what systemic changes do you think need to happen to prevent similar injustices in the future?
Well, I think the first thing is, the government needs to strip the post office. And I'm not too sure where we're up to on this, whether these powers have been suspended or they have already been stripped. But certainly, going back to the beginning of the year, as far as I'm aware, they were still in place. But I would strip the post office of its ability to prosecute. And basically, they've got prosecutorial powers themselves, but push them, if they are going to start prosecuting people, push them through the Crown Prosecution Service. So that's what the police have to do. We have to put the case together, present it to the Crown Prosecution Service. They oversee the paperwork, the investigation in some instances, if it's something really serious like murder. And basically, that generates a degree of impartiality. And that degree of impartiality is something that would likely, I think, in these circumstances, would have protected the individuals concerned, because the first thing the CPS would have done is made sure that the disclosure obligations were met. And because there was no independence, nobody really knows what's happened around the disclosure obligations. And I think that's the crux of the scandal. I'm not a fantastic fan of the Crown Prosecution Service, the CPS, because I think they can be insipid at times. They don't progress cases that clearly have merit, because they want to only progress cases that where, you know, success is almost guaranteed, which sort of flies in the face of why we have juries and Crown Courts, because in some instances the jury should decide. You know, that's the whole idea. We present the case and the jury makes the decision. I mean, the CPS precludes us from doing that sometimes. So on that basis, I know that the post office prosecutions would never have got past first base without having had the disclosure obligations adhered to, because the CPS would have been all over it, you know, to make sure that happened.
Obviously, I think a big part of our conversation today has been the lack of disclosures. What lessons do you think can be learned about the importance of disclosures and transparency in legal proceedings from this scandal? What do you think, you know, other countries or even just, you know, investigators in general can learn from this scandal?
I can only really speak to the UK, really. But as investigators, you know, if you're investigating the matter and it's going to be dealt with in front of the civil court, the rules are a bit more relaxed. But if you're endeavouring to put a case in front of a criminal court, each country has rules. And the first thing you've got to do is follow those rules. Because if you don't follow the rules, as we know, cases are going to get terminated, they're going to get kicked out. And if that happens, you know, sometimes that is down to you and error. And, you know, I've had cases fail. You know, we've all been there. But what I'm saying is that if you deliberately do not follow the rules, or if you are inclined to ignore the rules or not apply them as fully as you should, then the only likely outcome is either a miscarriage of justice, which is going to have ramifications for you as an investigator at a later date, or as we're finding here now, you know, the ramifications that, you know, they're all coming home to roost now for the post office people. And some of those post office people that I've seen are deliberately vague in their answers. They can't recall things. They don't remember things. They're trying to portray themselves as acting in silos. You know, Chinese walls in between them and the cohorts, and every time something gets pointed out, it wasn't them, it was somebody further up the line. Well, who was it? I don't know. I don't recall. Well, if you start putting that together, you end up with essentially a conspiracy. And as you've got a conspiracy, then you can see that it will get investigated by the police, there's nothing more certain. When the police get involved, that's what they're going to be doing, is trying to tease out who the ringleaders are, for want of a better explanation, and, you know, put a case together that is going to be suitable for going to court, and then whatever happens in front of the particular judge on the day. But the rules, the CPIA rules, are not complicated. They're very straightforward. And the way I always worked to them was I always erred on the side of safety. So, if anything, I over-disclosed rather than under-disclosed. And this is where the lawyers come into their own. If you've got a good criminal lawyer, they can guide you through what that you know, that those decisions between disclose or not to disclose. And that's where law firms like ours come into their own, really, where if we are looking at a private prosecution, well, the clients need to know that as criminal investigators and criminal prosecutors, we actually know what we're talking about, because otherwise they're going to spend a lot of money and then it's going to come tumbling around their ears. So it is important. But as I say, the main thing for me is that the rules are very simple, they're very straightforward, and if it's done properly, i.e. if the post office fall under the Crown Prosecution Service, for example, then everyone's going to err on the side of safety, and the chance of a miscarriage of justice is greatly reduced. And I think that's the takeaway from what's going on at the moment.
Kind of getting back to Horizon and its role, how do you think fraud examiners and forensic accountants should approach cases involving, you know, complex technologies, maybe that, you know, they don't understand, to avoid similar issues?
Well, again, it's not rocket science. As I've already declared, I struggle to turn my computer on and off. So if a case came in to me that involved technology, computers, software, then you've got to engage the right professionals, the right experts. You can guide you through that particular quagmire as well. There's no point in pretending that you know what you're talking about. And I've got to say, over the years, I've met quite a few people who have tried to bluff their way through things. I've done it myself in the past, and there's only one outcome. You're going to get found out. So for me, the way I would sell that to the clients is, look, we need to engage an expert, and then, you know, identifying the right expert, somebody who's got credibility, people who've used them before, people who can vouch for their expertise, you know, as investigators, as prosecutors, you're reliant on those expert witnesses. And there's, you know, don't get me wrong, there's nothing to be ashamed of, actually relying on an expert to guide you from point A to point B. And the Horizon software, again, looking at excerpts from the public inquiry, there's things, you know, they talk about things about they built a backdoor into the system that allowed the Horizon engineers, if they wanted to, could alter the accountancy system, change numbers, change figures, whatever it may be. And for a while, the post office were denying all of that. And it's coming out slowly but surely that people within the post office were aware. But because they knew that would have a negative impact on the criminal prosecutions that were underway or had already taken place, they buried that information as well. Well, if you've got an expert witness who understands all that, who perhaps you might be able to get access to the system in order to interrogate it and establish what, you know, what it can do. Well, that's going to be important to you and your case going forward. But as I say, I am aware of colleagues who've used experts in the past and they've turned out to be slightly less expert than the opposition. So you, I know that sounds daft, but if you put yourself forward as an expert, there'll be an expert for the defence, an expert for the prosecution. And whoever gets the best expert stands the best chance of winning. So again, they come at a premium price and a premium cost. And you've got to make sure that whoever you land upon, you make sure that they're capable of doing the job that you're asking them to do.
Closing thoughts. What advice would you give to legal professionals to ensure that they uphold justice and prevent this sort of misconduct in their cases?
I think I've already hit upon it, but you know, the basic thing is you've got to follow the rules. If there are rules in place, then you have to follow them. So for argument's sake, if I was working for a client and some of the criminality had happened in Switzerland, for example, well, I'm not an expert in Swiss law, I'm not an expert, you know, I don't know what the rules are around investigation work. So again, you just need to rely upon local expertise and you need to engage the right people. And I think one of the things, again, I've got to be careful because I don't want to put myself forward as being holier than thou, because I'm not. But what I'm saying this is that I've been doing this for 42 years now. I've seen virtually every mishap conceivable. I've seen cases get home that were thin as paper because the jury could see that, you know, the guy was guilty. And I've seen cases where the evidence has been insurmounting and juries have acquitted them. You know, it's not an exact science. And as long as you accept that it's not an exact science and just do your best to put together a case that stands a chance of victory, then that's what you're aiming for. And the other thing I would also say, I know speaking to investigators, again, there's no shame in looking at a case, having a go at it, and then realising that you're not going to get it past first base because you've only got finite resources. You've got to move on to the next job because flogging a dead horse doesn't do anybody any good. And I always remember when I was a young detective getting pulled to one side by one of the senior detectives and basically getting told that being a good detective most of the time was the secret was knowing which jobs to run with and which ones to leave behind. Because if you run with the right job, you're a good detective because you stand a good chance of getting it home. And if you abandon the dead horse and stop trying to beat it, then, you know, you've got time then to go on to the cases where you are going to win. So I think in this instance here, some of the prosecutions that I've seen via the traumatisations and one thing and another, you just look at them and just think to yourself, if that had come into a CID office with it, we wouldn't even have looked at it. And they've just pressed on with it. And the evidence, when you look at it, effectively is manufactured by the fact that the software has created it and the software is malfunctioning. And there was loads of indications that it was the software's problem. But they just seem to have pushed that to one side and just pressed ahead regardless. And I think this is where the problems arise.
Tony, thank you so much for all of your insight today. I know that this is something that we're going to continue to sort of see unravel in the news probably for quite a while. And I know that we're all very interested to see what changes are put in place in the future. So thank you for your insight. Thank you so much for being here with us today.
You're welcome. And hopefully people are still awake at this point.
And thank you for listening. You can find this podcast, along with all other episodes of Fraud Talk, on acfe.com, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. This has been Rihanna Scoggins, signing off.